How do community organizations serve the mental health needs of immigrants, given the different ways people understand the mind throughout the globe? In the case of the refugee experience, what do social workers and others do to understand the long, perilous journeys that might have left their own scars? I'm Gina Kaufman. On today's Central Standard, we'll hear about efforts to bridge cultural divides in the treatment and understanding of mental health issues. Plus, today is September 11th. It's been 13 years since terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. Our Tell KCUR segment checks in on how Kansas Cityans feel 13 years later. Stay with us.
Namaste, Tinyanagi Wandarani.
Rixin Wangmo walks from home to home in a public housing complex in the Argentine neighborhood of Kansas City, Kansas, greeting her clients. She works with Bhutanese refugees, people who were forced out of the Himalayan country of Bhutan. Since arriving in the United States, the refugees have been dealing with some serious culture shock. Wangmo helps them navigate both the streets of Kansas City and the complexities of employment, healthcare, and education in the U.S.
They have a stress. Some of them are depressed because of the language. They want to do something, but they just cannot understand. So they feel kind of helpless, totally helpless. Like, you go shopping, you don't know the language, they get frustrated because they need somebody to be with them, and they don't find that person.
Wangmo isn't part of the same Nepali ethnic group as the people she works with, but she is Bhutanese, and she knows their language and culture. In fact, she used to help out at a refugee camp in Nepal. She says cultural understanding is a big part of helping the refugees adapt and become more independent.
I wish we have some more of like me, 3-4 people like me who can reach them, help them to interpret, and teach them all the basic thing like guide them through the traveling, like in the buses, to explore.
Understanding where people come from and how they think is crucial in the mental health care arena because, as easy as this is to forget, cultural belief systems affect how we view just about everything. The mind and its troubles are no exception. So how do new immigrant groups arriving here in our area in significant numbers push local health care workers to adapt their approach? I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's the big question on today's Central Standard. Cecilia Ponce is my first guest in the live studio this morning. She's a therapist at Wyandotte Center in Kansas City, Kansas. Hi, Cecilia.
Hi, good morning, Gina. Happy to hear from you and to be here.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. I'm a bilingual therapist at the Wyandotte Center. I've been there for about 7 years now. I work with a number of different individuals and families in Wyandotte County. We serve anyone and everyone who comes in who's struggling with any type of mental distress. A little bit about myself. I have a master's degree from Washington University in St. Louis. I also have a licensure through the state of Kansas to be a therapist. I've lived in a number of different cities and states, including New York, which is where I got my undergraduate degree in anthropology from the University of Rochester. But I'm originally from Los Angeles and bicultural myself. I identify as being Mexican-American.
And how many generations has your family been here?
Oh, that's a tough question to answer. If you ask on my mother's side, they'll probably say about 2 or 3, depending on who you ask. And on my father's side, first generation.
So you can relate to a lot of the things your clients are going through.
Definitely.
So who are your clients?
Well, we serve a number of individuals who are American, refugee. We serve also like a huge Latino population. We're hovering just above 27% right now in terms of Spanish-speaking persons who identify as being Latino.
Shortly, we're going to turn to Ethan Waters, author of Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. But first, I want to talk a little bit more with some local people. We're also joined by Tara Burkhart, a social worker for Jewish Vocational Services, a group that works with refugees who have just arrived in Kansas City. Tara, where do the people you serve come from, by and large, and under what circumstances have they come to the U.S., to Kansas City?
Yeah, so we work with – oh, thank you for having me here. We work with refugees from all over the world. About 28% of the refugees that we resettle are from Somalia. About 22% are from Burma. 13% from Cuba, 13% from Iraq, and 5% from Sudan. However, we resettle refugees from over 28 different countries.
I hear you've started using a technique called narrative therapy with some of the communities you serve. Can you talk about what that is and why you use it?
Yeah, so we chose to go with narrative therapy rather than CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, or other therapies, because a lot of other therapies require a relatively high level of literacy. And our clients often have not had the opportunities to go to formal education. So we chose to choose narrative therapy because it is a form of therapy that allows us to share stories with clients.
Explain what it is a little bit more.
Yeah, so narrative therapy, ideally, it is a 10-session course. We start by doing an assessment, and then we go into the story of a client's life. We talk about what their life was like in their country of origin, what it was like to be in a refugee camp or in a second country where they were a refugee. And then we talk about their experience coming to the United States and what that's been like for them. And through that story, we take their experiences of trauma and we help them to identify their resiliency and their strengths.
So how is narrative formation like figuring into this bigger picture? Is there more of a tradition sometimes of storytelling in cultures of origin? Is that part of this?
Yeah, so a lot of our refugees come from cultures where storytelling is utilized as a modality of teaching and influencing change. And so when we have clients tell their stories, it's something that whenever they do narrative therapy, not only are they sharing their story with our clinician, but they're also drawing pictures using art therapy, and then they make a book. So at the end of the time of narrative therapy, they have a book with pictures and their story, and we use interpreters. So the very last session, what we do is we read the story back to our clients so they can hear all of the experiences they've had, the traumas that they've experienced, but also their resiliency and strength that they've used to get through those. And so then at the end of that, they have a story that they can share with other members of their community, or also they could share with their children.
What happens if resiliency isn't really what they identify in this story? I mean, do you have to really draw that out sometimes?
That is a lot of what we do. So I manage our social work program at Jewish Vocational Service, and our therapist is so amazing. And, we're very privileged to be able to hear clients' stories. And every single one of our clients has resiliency by virtue of being in this country right now. Only about 1% of the world's refugees, there's 10.5 million refugees in the world right now, only about 1% of the world's refugees even come to a third country like the United States. So by virtue of being here and still surviving, they're very resilient, and so we help them identify that.
So a question I want to ask both of you is, when people's lives have just been uprooted, often violently and traumatically, and they have yet to lay down new roots and establish a new life, how do you distinguish a mental health diagnosis from just a totally rational, understandable response to the circumstances? Or is that even a valid distinction? I'm thinking of the difference between like crying and you don't know why and crying because you just witnessed a terrible accident.
So at JVS, we actually asked this question a lot. And through that, we got funding from Jackson County Community Mental Health Fund and Healthcare Foundation of Greater Kansas City to help us provide services and kind of figure out how can we identify what clients are having a normal reaction to, like, maintaining roots in a new country and what's maybe something more. And so at 90 days in the United States, we actually do a mental health assessment with all of our clients to kind of identify as there's something that's happening more with some clients, or is this a normal feeling?
Cecilia Ponce, what about you?
Well, most of our referrals do come from other agencies as well as primary care physicians. So people come in with an understanding that they're referred to us for mental health services. And something like acculturation might fall into a diagnosis like adjustment disorder, not necessarily full-blown major depressive disorder or generalized anxiety disorder, or even PTSD. So we do a full thorough assessment of everyone who walks in through our doors.
Can you explain what adjustment disorder is?
Yes.
That's not necessarily a common term.
An adjustment disorder is an adjustment to any change in your life. It can be a phase of life change. It could be being uprooted from one country to another. It could be a divorce, a loss of job. It could be a number of different things. And the process of that can last from up to a month to even longer.
So an event triggers it.
Of course.
Interesting. And how do the experiences and cultural backgrounds of your clients factor into the issue of diagnosis more broadly for you?
Mm-hmm. Well, most of our clients, especially those who are refugees, have struggled with inter-ethnic conflict. They've witnessed things like rape, murder, bombings, killings, that sort of thing. And most of them do identify as trauma victims, people who have experienced horrendous things.
And do they identify that way themselves, like they would say, I have been traumatized?
Well, they might not necessarily use the word trauma, just like they might not necessarily use the word depression, but they might identify as something bad happened to me.
Why wouldn't they use these words?
Well, first of all, these are westernized ideas, and we don't impose our westernized views on our clients. We tend to work with the client on collaboration in terms of treatment, and they themselves are resilient, have active coping skills already in place. So it's kind of a marriage between, in my head, I know what the mental health diagnosis is. They have perhaps a different name for it, and we work together on treatment planning, and treatment planning may look different based on what the client is presenting with.
What are some examples of communities that are here in large numbers in Kansas City who have a different interpretation of something like depression or anxiety or trauma than the westernized view? And maybe walk us through how you do come up with that compromise and work together.
Well, specifically already mentioned is the Bhutanese community that's growing here in the Kansas City metro area. Each year in the state of Kansas, approximately 350 refugees are resettled. And of those, right now, the majority are Bhutanese, and they speak Nepali. Again, these are persons who have different ideas of how the world works. They have a complex caste system. And each caste is designated by their surname. Higher-born caste members are typically, like, revered, especially if they're elders. And for some of the more traditional members, they actually complete, like, purification rituals if a low-caste or low-born person enters their home. Keeping that in mind, we do have case management. And case managers are people who work with these clients in the community. And those, keeping that in mind, our agency hired Tika last year. And as a case manager, she spent countless hours in their homes and in the community working with translation also. And it helped tremendously that she was highborn and her father was a shaman or a priest in the community. Kind of gave us buy-in to work with the community.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, and KCUR's Alex Smith will be reporting more on the Bhutanese community in upcoming weeks. But are there ever ethical or professional challenges that come with the territory of maybe recognizing that your clients' cultural norms need to take precedence over our own? If the mental health community has ideas of correct, maybe, and incorrect ways of approaching certain things.
Yes, definitely. Even just defining or diagnosing. And I believe Tara probably can chime in at any point. But the reality is, even within the Latino community, we're talking about people who are coming from 20 different or 21 different communities or nations. And we're also talking about individuals who live throughout the United States, continuous United States, and in the territory of Puerto Rico. So people do have different ideas of what, for example, depression is. People might use depression as an umbrella term for a number of different disorders, although they have like a westernized idea of what depression is and what that means. I need to go in and seek services. That doesn't necessarily translate to, well, I'm having X, Y, and Z symptom clusters, and I need a typical protocol like CBT or EMDR to work through whatever it is that I'm struggling with.
I'm thinking of how you approach people. You know, have you ever had to adjust how you do that and maybe even go against the norms of the mental health establishment in how you approach someone?
Well, I wouldn't say it's against the norms of the mental health establishment to use cultural competency. Again, with working with individuals in the Latino community, we have several groups in Wyandotte County that participate in somewhat of a reverse like pilgrimage to the Virgin Mary, La Virgen de Guadalupe. So in these groups of families, they keep taking turns in keeping like the Virgin Mary in their homes. And when the groups get together in the home of the most needy, and that's identified by the client or of the family, they pray, meditate, show support for each other. And maybe part of the treatment plan might be, okay, well, if you're struggling this month, maybe you can have, you know, the peregrina or the pilgrimage in your home.
What about you, Tara?
I think that we frequently try to ask clients when, as a part of our therapies, we say, if you were feeling this way at home in your home country, what would you do? What steps would you take? And we try to help incorporate those components into the practices that we're doing. So sometimes that might be meeting with a religious leader and talking to them first before we maybe go into narrative therapy. We also often see that clients that we work with come from cultures where mental health and physical health aren't separated. And so that idea of having to go to a different doctor to talk about feeling sad or nervous is very foreign.
Wow, that's really interesting. We also here in the United States talk a lot about stigma surrounding mental health. Is that universal or does it affect communities and sufferers differently depending on where they come from?
I would say that that is very common for what we see in our populations. And also, you know, whenever we work with clients, we really have to step back and start where they might not know what these systems look like in the United States. We had a client that was from another country who was refusing to go to receive psychiatric assistance, and that was her right. But we kind of stepped back and we said, why is that? Why is this not something that you're interested in? And she shared that she had had a family member that had received electric shock therapy in their country of origin, and then they never saw that family member again.
Wow.
So there was a lot of fear around going because they didn't know what that meant.
So how did you work through that? I mean, that's its own traumatic experience.
Right. So what we did was we really started at the beginning and we said, you know, in the United States, what we do is we might first meet with a social worker, somebody that's just like me, and we'll talk about your experiences. And then you might meet with a doctor, and then the doctor will talk to you about medicine. And if you want to take medicine, you can. And if you don't, then that's your option also. But we really go through the step-by-step process of what it'll look like to go through that mental health system.
Cecilia, mm-hmm. Have your patients' perspectives on mental health and the human experience altered the way you understand any specific conditions?
Oh, yes, definitely. For example, I have clients who belong to a subculture that do believe in like brujos or curanderas, like priests or shamans. And they do believe in things like ritualistic cleansing. And we don't take any judgment. We take a non-judgmental stance. And in fact, sometimes we even incorporate or encourage them to use whatever skills they already have in place or resources. And that's actually one resource that isn't westernized at all.
Well, we are going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll bring Ethan Waters in on this conversation. He's the author of Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. Central Standard will be back in a few. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I've been chatting with Cecilia Ponce, a therapist at Wyandotte Center, and Tara Burkhart, a social worker for Jewish Vocational Services. Hello again, Cecilia.
Hi.
And welcome back, Tara.
Hi.
Now let's get author Ethan Waters in on this discussion about how people from different parts of the globe understand mental health. We'll want to take your calls, too, if you have questions or related experiences. 816-235-2888. Good morning, Ethan.
Good morning, Jenna.
What inspired you to write Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche?
Well, I've written several books about the mental health profession, and one of the ideas that I kept coming back to was the way in which cultural settings shape the human mind, shape our understandings of ourselves. And I realized I wrote books about how the therapy setting does. I realized I wanted to know more about how symptoms of mental illness are created partially by culture, and there's really only two ways to do that, to see the cultural influence. One is to look back across history, and the other is to look across cultures to see what is the same about these mental illnesses and what is different. And I started working on the book just at a generation where there was tremendously interesting research coming out of many universities that were documenting how it does indeed shape mental illness, how it's different across and different across places, that people in different places have what Edward Shorter, who's a psychiatric historian, calls different symptom pools, which is basically conceiving of the mental health symptom something like a language. Like, we will speak the language that is understood, we'll speak the language of suffering that is understood in our time and place.
A language of suffering. That's fascinating.
Right. So symptoms become like a communication of distress. And so if in one time and place the communication of distress might be something like the women around the early 1900s who displayed those remarkable signs of hysteria, which is the sensitivity to touch and the physical paralysis and the fainting. And that was, in their moment in time, that was understood as the language of mental distress. And our unconscious, this is not a matter of faking symptoms. This is not a matter of the symptoms being less real. This is a matter of our unconscious minds picking up an understanding of what our culture accepts as a symptom of as an expression of our mental stress, whether that might come from a trauma or a biological condition or something else. We shape our symptoms to what is known of that time, and those symptoms come and go over time. And so you have something like hysteria sort of going out of vogue, anorexia coming into vogue, anxiety coming into vogue and going away, depression coming into vogue and going away.
Going into and out of vogue sounds so funny.
It is, I think, yeah, the reasons they come in vogue and out of vogue are really, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book is to sort of see which cultural forces are at play. And of course, there's the drug companies are certainly at play in terms of defining what symptoms are legitimate in our time. There are the media, like you and I, when we see, you know, when we start to talk about the latest mental health system, you know, the girls that are cutting or the whatever new trend, we tend to be attracted to that. And when we write about it and put it on the radio. Then there's also the ways we go across culture. You know, I wrote in the book about how after the Boxing Day tsunami, we rushed into places like Sri Lanka with PTSD, with looking for, with very little cultural sense. And I've just been fascinated to listen to Cecilia and Tara talk about the ways they're trying to be culturally sensitive. It sounds like they're doing a remarkable job. But certainly if you come into a country 10 days after an event and you don't know the language, you don't know the rituals for grieving, you don't know the burial rites, and you have this checklist of PTSD, you're likely not to do what the healers you have on the show are doing, which is incorporate their cultural understanding of what they're experiencing, how they would heal into your ministrations. You're likely to do something that's fairly, I would say, ham-fisted.
One of the chapters in your book that really stuck with me was about schizophrenia in Zanzibar. Can you lay out for our listeners how schizophrenia is understood in Zanzibar and how communities there handle sufferers as a result of that understanding?
Right. Well, the idea of looking at schizophrenia in Africa came from after I read a WHO study that was a decades-long study that suggested that people in developing countries actually do better when they have suffering from schizophrenia over time than we do in the Western world. And there's many people in the cross-cultural psychiatry world that are trying to figure out that puzzle. What is happening in other countries that suggests that these people that suffer from schizophrenia do better? And I went down to interview an anthropologist in Zanzibar who was looking into the spirit possession narrative as it's applied in Zanzibar and the shamanistic rituals.
So explain what that is.
So it's the idea that symptoms of schizophrenia would come from being spirit.
Being possessed.
Being possessed, right. And the interesting thing in Zanzibar is that many people share this spirit possession narrative. You don't have to be of schizophrenia to believe that your mind is permeable to the spirit world and you're influenced by it. It's a very common belief. So that belief, as it was applied in Zanzibar, actually had the effect of keeping the ill person within the group. It wasn't a thing you ostracized them for. It kept you in the group. It allowed you to do all sorts of ministrations for them, bring them tea, you know, make them comfortable, do all these things that kept them within the family, within the group. And that, this anthropologist believed, was the sort of the central thing about the central good outcome of that narrative was not that they didn't believe that they were possessed by spirits, and neither do I, but she believed that narrative, as it was applied in Zanzibar, actually kept them in the group and not ostracized. Whereas the diagnosis of schizophrenia in the United States tends to be those things that allows us to see the ill individual as the other, as someone that is really beyond the, you know, on the other side of almost, you know, not being human like us. And that is a really important thing when considering any mental health narrative, is that does it keep the individual in the group or does it ostracize them from the group?
So when what you've said something that really interests me here, which is that while you haven't adopted the belief that, that generates the kind of behavior that seems to be really successful, that you see that associated with that belief is a different kind of behavior. And so is it it's not so much a question of what we know, how much we know, but how we apply that knowledge, that that maybe we've got some cause and effect things that we've taken for granted, that but that we could learn things from other approaches.
Well, you know, the brain chemistry narrative is also there's an amazing amount of research and actual data about it, but it's also a way that we explain our lives. And as a narrative,
that's a belief system.
It works as both a science, you know, there's science behind it, but it is a belief system. And you know, in the same way, the shaman narrative, there is a religious aspect to it, but it is also sort of a belief system about how the mind works. And I'm all about outcomes. You know, I don't mind, you know, for someone who's mentally ill, I don't mind what they believe. I want to know what the better outcome is in terms of whether they can get married, whether they can carry a job, whether they stay within the family, a happy life. And I have no desire to sort of convince them of my, you know, if the spirit possession narrative works better for them, keeps them within the group, happier over time, I just don't think, the cruelest person in the world would go in there and try to dissuade them of it and convince them of the brain chemistry narrative. If that is a foreign narrative to them, if that is the narrative that's going to make them feel disconnected from the group, less like the people around them, why would we do that?
Cecilia Ponce, what are your thoughts as you listen to what Ethan is saying and think about your international clients here in Kansas City?
Yeah, that actually brought to mind several cases of persons in Wyandotte County that receive services from Wyandotte Center who are, you know, Latino, Spanish-speaking, and struggle with hearing voices. As we know, as people are under higher levels of stress, their symptoms get worse, and when their stress levels are lower, they tend to get better. We have several individuals who have asked for us to actually partner up with other community members like priests to do things like bless the home. And that has actually helped.
And do you think that's because the stress is lowering?
Definitely, but also because it's working within their perception of what they're defining as the problem. The problem there being the secondary idea that there might be like demons or there might be spirits or things that might need to be cleansed from the home.
What about you, Tara? Do you have clients whose stories are really resonating with what you're hearing Ethan say?
Yeah, I think that we've had several clients that we've worked with that have come in and talked about hearing voices or needing religious things that they haven't been able to find in the United States. So sometimes what we'll do is even just help connect those religious resources that they might not know exist here. So one client, they used incense and to help cleanse the smells of their home, and they couldn't find it. And so one of the things that we did in case management, which is often what we do before we even get into therapy, is we help them find those resources. And he did so much better after receiving those that, you know, we were able to adjust some of the plans that we had set forth.
So that brings back in some ways that question of, is it the circumstances or is it the mind? You know, mm-hmm. The circumstances are that I'm not connected to the religious community I'm used to being a part of. I can't find the things that anchor me in my own rituals. Could you talk a little bit more about some of the non-mental health things that you can do to really help the mental health situation?
Yeah, so that's actually a huge component of our program. We have the narrative therapy, which is so vital and has helped so many of our clients. But the bigger portion of what we do at JVS and our social work program is intensive case management. And intensive case management might be identifying work opportunities or helping clients get stable housing. Maybe they're living in a housing environment where there's 7 or 8 people in one house and they've never, you know, they need something a little bit different. It might be that they have physical health issues that they're not getting treatment for. And so we will do a lot of work to help clients get connected to primary care first. We have a lot of clients come in talking about headaches or feeling like they're having heart attacks, which could be anxiety or it could be any number of things. But we really try to help clients rule out those physical health issues if that's where they're at.
Yeah, and I would agree. I mean, something as basic as not having access to food is a mental health issue. If you're not eating, you don't have the energy to, you know, improve your mood, much less get out of the home, much less participate in a community. So connecting clients to things like Roots for Refugees or local food pantries is a big part of case management and what we do as well.
Something else that Ethan's been talking about is the way that communities can relate to people who suffer from mental health conditions, both in the U.S. and elsewhere, and that part of what he's seen, at least in Zanzibar, is that there's a different relationship between the community and the sufferer. Have you witnessed that?
Not specifically in the Latino community. In the Latino community, there is a strong pull towards family and community already. And a lot of people who come in actually come in with a family member or come in with someone who is a member of their church family.
And do you treat them in the company of that person?
Definitely. I mean, we obviously, our mental health center, have to acquire the appropriate releases, but we do work with the family.
And that's really interesting. Tara, do you do this narrative therapy that you were talking about earlier in the show, where people help you help people construct their narratives in a way that highlights resilience and other really positive outcomes? Do you do that one-on-one or in groups?
What we have found is we've offered it in groups and individual, and the majority of our clients have chose that they want to do it individually.
But why is that, do you think?
I think that some of it is that a lot of the clients that we end up seeing in social work are people that have come to the United States alone and maybe don't have other family members here. Or maybe it's a wife that came to the United States and she filed her petition for resettlement prior to her husband. And so she's here with her children and her husband's not here yet. So it might be that they have been separated from family members, and so they want to do that individually. The groups that we have done, they've all been family. We've tried to offer it for more of a community type of thing, and we've had a hard time getting clients to sign up for that option. But we are working with community leaders right now to talk about, is this something that people might be interested in if we reformatted it in some ways? So,
Ethan, you know, I imagine that there are a lot of pitfalls that can arise when you're talking with people about really, I mean, what we're talking about is being really open-minded about what constitutes a healthy mind and what constitutes a troubled mind, and just what that means in a broader context. Do you run into just difficulties of this or that, one or the other, when you're trying to have this conversation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, certainly, some people might take what I said a couple minutes ago and assume that I'm saying that the mental health issues we have in the West are damaging, and those that are in Zanzibar are great. And it really is not that the lines cannot be drawn that certainly that narrative about the biomedical brain and the chemistry in your brain is certainly a narrative that in the West, you know, people have told me, you know, that narrative saved my life. It allowed me to explain myself and my difficulties to my family. It kept, you know, it did that thing. It kept me within their group. They understood it as a sickness, and that worked very well for them. And certainly in other parts of Africa and other parts of the world, that spirit possession narrative, excuse for the worst forms of cruelty towards a mentally ill person. So it really does depend on what these ideas, what the words, you know, the stories we tell about the mental illness, what effect they have in our life in terms of, you know, primarily in relationships with the other people around us. And we need to be very careful, I think. I mean, the warning I've given that basically sums up my book is that we need to be very careful to go into other cultures and say, well, this is the way to think about mental illness because it is the truth. It is based on science. You know? Without understanding that those beliefs and those narratives actually, it matters, you know, those what the outcome beliefs are in terms of the relationships in those people's lives.
I'm going to turn to Cecilia Ponce. Earlier, we were talking about a pretty similar thing, this idea that you adjust what you're doing and you don't let go of your Western training as a therapist, mm-hmm. but nor do you ignore where people are coming from. You find a compromise.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about just certain practices and behaviors where you have had to adjust your approach without letting go of it?
Yes, definitely. As an agency, we have policy, and as a professional, we have a code of ethics. And I'm thinking particularly about gift giving. In the Latino community, it's not odd to receive small tokens of gifts, whether it's knickknacks or whether it's food or even something that they've made or created. And really, it would be a disservice or considered somewhat shameful to not accept that gift. And I learned that pretty early on in my career.
Tara, what about you?
We've had very similar experiences. And with our code of ethics, we aren't allowed to accept gifts. And so what we've done is we've said, you know, thank you so much for offering us this gift. It's been our privilege to work with you and hear your story. But what we do is we then might donate that gift to JBS and put it on the wall or use it in some capacity at JBS.
Well.
We're going to take a short break. If you have questions for our guests or stories to share, call 816-235-2888. We'll finish up this conversation about serving the mental health needs of immigrant communities in Kansas City after the break. We'll also check in on this week's Tell KCUR. Stick around. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Tara Burkhart of Jewish Vocational Services, Cecilia Ponce of Wyandotte Center in Kansas City, Kansas, and author Ethan Waters, who wrote Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. We're talking about how people around the world think about the mind and whether mental health practitioners need to take those variations into account when working with immigrant communities. And Tara Burkhart, do you have a story for us that might really illustrate some of this?
Yeah, so we actually talked to a client and he gave us permission to share some details of his story. And I think that this best shows the resiliency and the strengths of clients and also the traumas that they've experienced. So we have a client who, when he was 4 years old, his parents were killed. And so he went to live with his aunt and uncle and lived with them for 2 years until Burmese soldiers came and killed his aunt and uncle. He had no other family left, so he had to work on a farm for the next 10 years. But he felt like he was always in danger in Burma. Soldiers would come in and burn down houses and disrupt living situations.
He felt like he was always in danger. And in fact, it sounds like he was always in danger.
Yeah. And so what he did is he and his wife, he was married at this time, fled to Thailand, where they lived in a refugee camp. And UNHCR, the UN Higher Commissioner for Refugees, would provide food for the family every month, but it wasn't enough to feed the family. So he would go out and work jobs and work all day and bring home maybe $2 in money, and realized that he wasn't able to provide the future for his children that he wanted. So after 12 years of living in a camp, he was able to come to the United States, got a job, was doing really tremendously. But life happens here too. And what happened was he was walking to the bus one day so that he could go to work, and he was mugged and beat up. A short time after that.
Which is terrible.
Awful. A short time after that, he was in a really awful car accident on the way home from work. And then maybe like a month or two following that, he had a daughter who drowned in Burma. And so while he was doing well in the United States, he was really starting to experience some of those symptoms of depression. He was very sad and withdrawing from his family.
And anyone losing a child would experience those, even without all the other stuff.
Absolutely. And so he came in to we actually provided about 6 months of case management because he had a lot of health issues from the car accident. So we got him some health and got him connected with some more stable housing. He got on food stamps for a while because he wasn't able to work as much. So we did some case management, but he still wasn't thriving. He was doing okay, but he wasn't thriving. So he did our narrative therapy sessions. And now he's working full time again. And this is what he said at the end of the story. And I was just going to read his quote. But he said, "Our problems in Burma were bigger than problems like this. Here in the U.S., I had police to help me. My children can go to school. I can talk to my friends and family. And on Sundays, we can go to church and play soccer. Some scary things have happened to me here. But in this place where I live now, I feel safe."
So that was the end of the story that he wrote based on this narrative therapy.
Yeah.
So do you see the ends of the stories as sort of launching places for the rest of a person's life and their mental health
Absolutely. I think that it helps show, you know, I've been through all these traumas and I've used this skill or that skill to get through it. And I can do that again in the future. And maybe there's a point where I'll need help again. Maybe some things will happen. But now, rather than having to start at the very beginning with telling my story, maybe I can show my new therapist this book and then we can kind of start from where we left off.
Is this something, narrative therapy, is it something that is used outside of these communities? I mean, is it sort of mainstream here in the U.S. or is it really specially tailored to immigrant communities?
I think it definitely is a form of therapy that's widely known globally, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds really logical. Mm-hmm. So, Cecilia, what about you? Do you have stories that you're sort of allowed to share with us? Or,
well, because of confidentiality, obviously, I can't identify any clients. But I can speak specifically to clients who, we have about 4 Spanish-speaking therapists, and we often share families. We often joke about between the 4 of us, maybe we share about 10 families. But the reality is, like, the population in Wyandotte County is growing every day. And again, we do have clients who do have other views of how to work through trauma. And I'm thinking specifically of a few families who do have this ritualistic idea of shamanism or curanderas. And specific to trauma or abuse, really do believe in incantations. And honestly, I've seen, like, probably the best, like, you know, results from people who incorporate both that and an evidence-based practice like CBT or narrative therapy or even eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
Can you explain what that is, desensitization and reprocessing?
Oh, sure. EMDR was actually created specifically for trauma. It's pretty wide known now, but about 10 years ago was considered still kind of borderline, maybe emergent-based therapy. But today it is used by the VA and as well as licensed therapists across the country.
What is it?
The idea behind it is that there's both the left and right hemisphere of the brain. And after traumatic events, not only do the original images and the memories stay in your mind, but also some of the physical bodily sensations and emotional responses. So the idea behind bilateral stimulation, and that can be done either through eye movement or the use of a pulsar or a light bar to stimulate both left and right hemisphere of the brain. It actually pushes or encourages neurons to complete full cycles, and it's also a form of self-soothing.
So you combine these very sort of medical, physiological treatments, very physiological treatments, with something like incantations. How does that work? Can you explain how that plays out?
Sure. So, I mean, typically people go out into the community, and there are people that are well-known in the community that perform these types of lavados or cleanses, and the idea behind that is that they'll go and do that kind of as a prep work and then come in and do the groundwork for EMDR in session.
And do you talk to them afterwards about how these two things work together, or do you just observe the effects?
No, we definitely talk about before and after.
What do people say about how these two things complement each other? Do they talk directly about that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. The idea behind EMDR is that you don't have to go too deep into the actual trauma, but with, for example, like shamanism, they also don't go too deep into the trauma. So for persons who might not be open to things like narrative therapy or be ready to, you know, just divulge, those two combined actually work hand in hand.
Tara, we're going to be concluding this conversation very shortly, but what are some of the populations that are just arriving here in large numbers that maybe local therapists haven't seen before?
So the newest group that we're starting to see in large numbers are Congolese clients, and a lot of our Congolese clients come with very, very big families, so 11 or 12 people in a family. We're also seeing, we have a lot of Burmese refugees that might not have been seen.
Well, thanks so much to all of our guests. We're going to have to wrap up this conversation now, but it's been great having you. Tara Burkhardt, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Cecilia Ponce, thanks for taking the time out of your day.
Thank you, Gina.
And thank you, Ethan Waters, author of Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche.
Thank you so much.
We'll have this conversation archived at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Why don't you talk to me? Obama's speech last night coincided with the anniversary of September 11th.
Tomorrow marks 13 years since our country was attacked. Next week marks 6 years since our economy suffered its worst setback since the Great Depression. Yet, despite these shocks, through the pain we felt and the grueling work required to bounce back, America is better positioned today to seize the future than any other nation on Earth.
KCUR's social media producer Allison Rollitz joins us for this week's Tell KCUR segment. And the September 11th anniversary was front of mind with this week's question.
If you looked at the Twitter conversation in Kansas City going on this week, and if you specifically search for 9/11 or September 11th, there actually were a lot of people talking about how they wondered whether or not there would be any additional attacks or anything by ISIS because of the 9/11 anniversary happening today. It was really
People had it on their minds.
It was definitely on people's minds. And so we really wanted to go ahead and ask people, how safe do you feel in Kansas City 13 years after 9/11?
That's a big question. What were some things people said?
Well, nobody said that they felt unsafe, so I'll just get that out there from the get-go. But actually, the biggest sentiment that we heard back is that people felt unsafe because of other things besides international terrorists, if that makes sense, not because of ISIS or because of 9/11 or because of that. And let me elaborate a little bit
with some
of the answers. For instance, Rebecca on Facebook, she said, "I'm more worried about local police than I am about a few extremists 1,000 miles away." Ross, also on Facebook, said, "I'm far more concerned about 20-something males with assault rifles and anger management issues." And I'm going to kind of go through a little list of more similar things like that. Kat said, "I'm more scared of an active shooter or the general violence that permeates the KC area than I am of a terrorist attack." And at the short and long on Twitter said, "If I feel less safe, it has to do with the rise in senseless mass shootings and violent crime perpetrated by Americans on Americans." And so I read all those just because we found it really interesting that they brought that up, because they kind of are talking about, or at least describing, a lot of recent violent incidents that have happened in Kansas City. You know, a few months ago, we had the shooter targeting Jewish centers in Johnson County. 5 people are now dead after a series of shootings that went from South Kansas City last week to the Northland. And then also late last week, all of Johnson County College Community College campus was shut down as police look for a suspicious person with a weapon, and they never found that person. So it's interesting that we've kind of had these recent acts of violence at home, and that's kind of what people say they're more scared of than terrorists.
It's such a sad statement, really, when you think about it, that there's so much catastrophic news that there are seemingly infinite reasons to be scared if you were inclined to feel that way.
Exactly.
There wouldn't be much of a struggle to find a reason.
Now, we did have a gentleman, Peter, on Facebook. He talked about how that ISIS is really not the first militant group out there that target Americans. And then he said, quote, "We will almost certainly be attacked by at least one of them at some time in the future. At this time, though, I'm less concerned with that than I am with politicians on both sides using ISIS as a re-election tool."
And any other comments about the Middle East in particular?
Not really, no. Like I said, like most people really took the question and took it like with other things that they were afraid of. There also is a general sentiment of just kind of the safety feeling that we feel in Kansas City. Like, we didn't ask people, do you think there's going to be a terrorist attack somewhere in the United States or the globe on 9/11? We asked people, how safe do you feel in Kansas City 13 years later? And so we had a few folks say, just like this person at Vintage Baubles, she said, "Kansas City as a whole feels like a pretty safe place to live." And that comment actually drew a little bit of fire on Twitter. Like, people started spouting back statistics like, oh yeah, tell that to the number of people who have been murdered in Kansas City this year, and things like that. But overall, like herself and another architecture firm, SFS Architecture, said they felt fairly safe in Kansas City, but the architecture firm said they're concerned about the recent unrest happening abroad. So it's definitely on people's minds, and people are talking about it a lot. But when you really get down to it and ask them, how safe do you feel in Kansas City, they feel pretty safe from terrorists, but pretty unsafe from active shooters and other acts of violence.
Well, yeah, that's really interesting. 9/11, so it's been 13 years. That's crazy. Do you remember Kansas City on September 11th when it actually happened?
I wasn't in Kansas City. I was a student journalist at K-State, and I was assigned to report on the massive amount of commercial airliners that were supposed to land at the Salina campus that day. But they were actually rerouted, and I ended up having to do a different story. But I do remember it was just a very interesting day to be a journalist and to just have the opportunity to talk to people and get their reactions from what was going on, especially in an aviation setting. Were you here in Kansas City on that day?
I was, and it was sort of an eerily beautiful blue sky kind of day that just really stood in contradiction to how I think people were feeling. But the thing that I remember being sort of strange just on the surface of it was that the gas stations just had these huge lines. People were afraid that they weren't going to be able to get their cars filled up.
Sure.
So I guess we're all still driving cars with gas in them 13 years later.
Definitely.
That was Allison Rollitz, KCUR's social media producer. And that's a wrap for today's show. You can listen back to today's conversations or any segments you've heard on Central Standard by going to kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for a podcast while you're there. Tomorrow, the food critics join us for a roundup of menus in and around town making good use of local seasonal produce. Plus, we'll take you foraging for the pawpaw, also known as the Missouri banana. Never heard of it? That's okay. We'll school you. Central Standard is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross and Matthew Long Middleton, with lots of help from interns Christina Leffring and Matt Hodapp. Alex Smith brought us the sound at the top of the hour. I'm Gina Kaufman. The standard's been set. Stick around for Up to Date. That's coming up next.